Okay. The electrons are coursing through the wires. Here we go.
I can hear them, actually.
I know. It's that low hum. That low hum in the cerebral cortex. Yeah, this just puts me in the mood. You know, this science groove here I'm listening to. Maybe I'll turn it up just a little bit, just for fun.
Whoa.
Oh, that's scary. Man, I don't want the neighbors will shut us down here. All right, there is the last, I hear the last little shake of the maraca. That indicates it's time for Radio Science News. Good morning, Robert Strong.
Good morning, Richard Pollack. Hey, guess it is indeed time for Radio Science News. Hey, you know, I was looking through my notes.
Yes.
And I realized that today, January 29th, 2022, is episode number 823 in a series.
Wow.
And what's really neat about that is that it's a prime. But it's not just a prime, it's a twin prime with our previous episode, not last week, because there are no twin primes in a row.
Yeah.
But we're a twin prime with our episode 821, January 15th.
Yeah, there we are.
So, very cool. I love twin prime. So, this is a twin prime today. And I am in beautiful downtown Frozen Wheeling, West Virginia.
There you go.
when I turned on the news this morning, they said it is 6 degrees F.
Ooh.
And I went, yeah, F. Then I was wondering what the wind chill was. It's so cold here, they didn't even say what the wind chill was.
No, they don't want people
to
be frightened.
That's how cold it is.
It's so frightening.
Burr.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, I just want the raw temperature. That the whole wind chill thing, like people will come in at the break going, oh my, and I'm thinking, yeah, but what's the actual temperature? You know, I can figure all the rest of that stuff out. Just give me the temperature. Give it to me straight. Well, anyway.
Give it to you straight.
It's, you know, needless to say, I'm in a slightly warmer place, but, you know, that could change. Who knows? I know that you guys didn't have any big severe wind warnings, which we had.
No.
So,
no.
You almost lost my cowboy hat. It was really dangerous out here.
Your cowboy
hat?
Oh,
man, I'm telling you. Dangerous winds. So anyway, look, we've got, why don't you get these folks to the launch pad of science, because I have, of course, I carried a few topics over from last week because we didn't get to all of them. And of course, I tend to, this is the piling on of science. We have even more topics that we're not going to get through, but.
The piling on of science.
We'll
I
do
like
our best.
Phrase.
We'll do our best. That's for the sports people out there. You know, like you and I are big sports fans. And
no, I'm not.
Piling on is important.
Piling on of science. Okay. So if our listeners, and again, it's nice that you folks said tuned into Radio Science News, episode number 823, January 29th, 2022. If you go to my favorite webpage on the internet, get us started. That's www.smartcenter.org, SMARTCENTER.org. And that'll take you to a fabulous webpage with all kinds of fun stuff. But the first thing that you'll really come into contact with is a little trifecta rainbow, the little, rainbows that in triplicate say Radio Science News. Just above that is the link to the launch pad of science, and I'm going to turn that on, and just as you are for the first time looking at it, so am I. We've got all kinds of fun stuff here. We've got the Omicron peak
question mark
with a question mark. We've got Omicron BA
dash bird Yeah, two BA2.
Bachelor's of Art?
I know it's been studied, but this is... you will not be surprised that they're actually talking about further variants, but you know...
Oh, no, not that.
Yeah, well, we'll just hit
and
it.
And then Blazar.
Blazar. Now, these next three things are all sort of celestial things.
MWA.
That refers to what I really... Both of these talk about a bunch of really amazing telescopes. Something? No, this the it has to do with an array. It's a wide array.
Gotcha.
And you know, for Aussies,
array.
The Murchison. This is about a big array in the southern hemisphere that's doing some cool things.
Gotcha.
Meteorites, and then Robert, you're going to have a reason to party. I've got party with exclamation mark because
this is it.
If for everybody that has not filled out their nerd party. Nerd science party calendars. This is some things to celebrate in 2022. We'll talk about.
Okay,
that.
Good. And then green hydrogen.
Green hydrogen. Hot times. Heat. ECAT PV. I mean, there's so much going on here. But the most important story, of course, short of the baboon spider story, which I included for your benefit, Robert.
Baboon spider.
There's big news about cat brains, and we're going to have to look into that. We cannot. We certainly cannot, we must not fail and skip that story today. We have to get the cat brain story. Ice, iron, X3872, and Neanderthals. It's all there, Robert. It's all
wow,
there.
Everything.
Well, so, tell you what.
Yes.
I was thinking that Omicron peak was probably more important than cat brains, but maybe we should just, just for fun, let's do cat brains first. What do you
cat
think?
Cat brains. Okay.
So
I am all for cat brains.
I know that you're concerned. Once you were intrigued by that topic, this will make perfect sense to everybody. And then, I mean, it might even explain a lot of the YouTube videos that people post all over the world here. So check this out. This is as of January 27, 2022. Report.
It says... brain size found to have increased in domesticated cats.
No, decreased.
That's the
shocking news.
I was hoping that it had increased, and therefore my brain, being that it is the size of a house cat, my brain wanted it to be increased, and therefore that's what I said. Isn't that funny? It's decreased. Is that because we are feeding them?
I'm not. You know, that's an interesting thing. There, part of what concerns me, because I consider, like, you know, like I would consider you and myself to be domesticated males, male humans. And so,
yes, true.
Having grown up as a teenager reading Conan the Barbarian, where I was thinking the barbarians seemed really sharp and, you know, pretty smart about things. There was always the collision between is it better to live, you know, in a wild environment or does civilization does it make us soft in many ways, physically and mentally?
Oh, sure.
So anyway, but this is a cool story. I just, when I saw this, I thought I have to include this because I've been dealing with meeting a cat that my daughter just got recently, and it's a very interesting cat. It seems smarter than most cats, so I'm not sure how this all works. But what they've really done here is a study, and I was surprised to see that it says to date, this decrease in brain size among domesticated animals has been seen in dogs, sheep, and rabbits.
What? I wonder about cows.
Well, that's what I'm saying. This is all very interesting. The thing that they had to do here in the case of, and of course there's a nice chart down here, you know, most cats won't be able to read it anymore because they just don't have the... because the palate length and the cranial volume of the cats has changed. And so, you know, I know that a lot of people, in fact, if you had a cat and you pointed a laser pointer at these charts, the cat would read them all day long. I can tell you that.
So it says here in this new effort, the researchers wondered if the same was true of house cats, which first became domesticated approximately 10,000 years ago. Okay.
Yeah.
So I would think that somebody somewhere has a whole bunch of skulls of house cats that they found over the years, And if you were to figure out how old the cat skull was, you could then
you could do a progression.
The volume of cat skull over time, and even though cats come in, you know, small sizes of medium and large, you should be able to figure this out.
Well,
but I don't see a graph in the five graphs of skull size over time.
See, now you're looking at it more closely than a normal cat would. It would turn out, Robert, what they really did was they, within the same time frame, because what you said makes perfect sense, except, you know, the collection of all that would be complicated. They've actually gone back to the original, you know, feral African, the cat that they believe they all evolved from. And, I mean, in a short, because I want to cover so many other topics, I did find, it says, research has suggested that the reason brain size decreases in domesticated animals is because of the decrease in neural crest cells, which are the brain cells involved in, here's the part that's important, processing and responding to threats.
Oh, because if you're a cat that lives at home,
absolutely,
your threats go down.
Yeah, the threat. So domesticated animals, just in general, face far fewer threats than do those in the wild. And of course, until the last minute when the cows are herded into the processing plant, but that's, you know,
exactly.
Their awareness of that is not so good. Anyway, very interesting story. And as you suggested, lots of ways of doing it, but basically, it says brain size of cats was generally in between that domesticated, well, the wild African cats. They're talking about European cats. So those are actually wild cats.
Right.
And of course, there are variations of the hybrids among the cats. Anyway, just I wanted to get that story in quick because, I mean, I was concerned. There's nothing that would be... The other thing that I would have to point out is that the idea that there's always a connection between, say, innate intelligence and processing and the size of the brain is not real, does not really hold up completely. Because, you know, people, well, you know, that an elephant must be a whale and an elephant. A lot of it has to do with things beyond just the mere size of the brain. So, you know.
Yes.
So,
okay.
So when people call
very
me,
interesting.
People say, call me a fathead, I don't feel so bad anymore. Well, let's jump back to the stories that probably are quite important right now. We had a story last week where Omicron variant was 99.5% of the new cases showing up. Now, I just want to quickly kind of jump into the story of what's going on with Omicron. The first story is kind of a positive thing, and the second one is like gives us pause, you know, as we have to consider, you know, as one variant goes, will there be another? So the first one, has Omicron peaked? And I think they're looking at Marion County in Florida.
They're saying that cases dropped for a second week in a row. Well, you know, just because it's been dropping for 2 weeks in a row, I would like to see it drop for 4 or 5 or 6 weeks in a row to really start to see that something's happening.
Well, and I will have to say that there's probably pretty good evidence now from various locations. I mean, like the whole United Kingdom and parts of Africa.
Yeah.
And that the Omicron variant basically took over as the predominant strain of this virus, and it kind of came on quickly, and then it's kind of like a prairie fire. It's people say, well, you know, the fire seems to be decreasing, and you go, this is because it's burned all the grass. You know, that's the
exactly.
It's kind of a depending on how you look at it. There certainly is good news to the fact that we may be able to say that. The two good things: one, if the Omicron among, and again, I put this caveat among vaccinated folks has ended up being a relatively, you know, less harmful situation. And then it comes and goes quickly. And, of course, the third thing is that they do feel that it leaves behind some, you know, resistance to further infection. Those are all kind of good things. But we can't, we can't be too blasé and cheerful about it, because I'm going to just jump to the second story. And I was wondering about when we would see some discussion of another variant. Now, this story actually, it has some scary news, but then it has some good news in it, too. So, and I had not heard of this until I actually did some research yesterday to see, well, what's new in the world of Omicron. And this is called a subvariant, Omicron subvariant BA 0.2, what we know so far. So
okay. It says the severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 SARS-CoV-2 Omicron variant concern has spread rapidly since its emergence in late 2021. Presently, an Omicron subvariant known as BA2, first identified in late 2021, has made headlines due to its rapid spread. So obviously this BA2 spreads even faster.
Yeah, they're talking
is that
about
what we're thinking?
Well, and it talks about the fact that I guess they're calling the one that we were dealing with BA1 and BA2. It says they're about 20 mutations apart. Interestingly, the two Omicron sublineages are sister clades that split from each other several months ago. And it's not that BA2 just evolved from the BA1.
Right.
But it says both carry a roughly comparable mutations relative to the ancestral, but they're different. Now, I mean, the one good thing is they're certainly watching this closely, and I think it said something about it's 1.5 times, you know, quicker spreading than the Omicron. Now, the bottom line from this, because I'll let folks read through this in more detail. And they're even talking about there's a BA3. They've actually indicated that the BA2 may be less severe somewhere here. But the big deal that I'm going to, not that this is always, you know, it's kind of like it's hard to tell anybody who's had the Omicron variant after, you know, hiding, being able to, you know, successfully evade any virus for 2 years, and then at the end, so many people have gotten the breakthrough Omicron.
Right.
But apparently from this article, it does state in here somewhere that the Omicron variant that we're dealing with now, if you've had a previous Omicron, it looks like not only are the vaccines still pretty good against it, but that you have further resistance by having, you know, gone through a breakthrough of the Omicron. So anyway, the story goes on.
The thing that jumps out at me as I'm scanning through this, it says this variant has been termed the stealth variant
due to
a mutation that renders it invisible as Omicron to PCR testing.
Yeah,
that's not a good thing.
Well, and the only thing that I would say is that I was talking to somebody about the various tests, and one of the things that they were saying that the antigen tests, you know, like the ones that have been sent, we haven't talked about the fact that I know people that ordered the free test from that President Biden mentioned, and they've already gotten the test.
Good.
I think it's the Binax now, or the antigen tests actually are apparently very accurate, or very good at almost comparable to the PCR in terms of, you know, they measure the, you know, the particular antigens, and they were saying if there's anything that's interesting about them. A lot of times it says that I was talking to my son-in-law, who is a microbiologist and a pharmacy researcher, and he was saying that in a lot of the tests, the one thing that you have to realize is that it's very possible that you could be testing positive and still not be capable of spreading it, because what you're actually measuring are all the components of it, and a lot of times say, like, if you were shedding the virus itself, the COVID virus, it's actually completely inactivated because all the binding sites have been, you know, tied up.
Gotcha.
So,
yeah.
So in a way, it's kind of it's the kind of stuff that you can only look at as anecdotal and, you know, as sort of interesting stuff that we'll look back on as we hopefully see this in the rearview mirror.
Now, well, way, way, way small in the rearview mirror.
I really want that to be soon as possible. Now, I saw this first story about, you know, we're always talking about interesting things, quasars and magnetars and all kinds of interesting deep space things. This first one was really interesting. And I was so intrigued because not so much about the fact that a blazar, which is a very interesting celestial object, But the way they talked about how using the telescope techniques, interferometry and stuff, they were able to visualize this. So I'm going to click on Blazar. Highest resolution view of the heart of a blazar achieved.
So the heart of a blazar, it says an international team including several researchers from the Max Planck Institute for radio astronomy in Bonn. Is that James?
No. Bonn.
has mapped the active galaxy OJ287 with an angular resolution of 12 micro arc seconds. Okay, that's
tech
pretty
talk
cool.
Right there, boy. That's tech talk.
That's really, really, really cool. So a micro arc second is a millionth of an arc second.
That is really something.
There are 60 arc seconds in an arc minute, and there are 60 arc minutes in a degree. The full moon in the sky appears to be about one half of a degree across. All right.
Wow. So the resolution of this thing is really amazing.
So the resolution of this is unbelievable. Wow. All right.
Well, the other part that's unbelievable is, despite the fact that the Russians are spending all their time on the border of Ukraine, they were able to help out with this. It says here talking about being the currently highest resolution that can be achieved with astronomical observations, and it was made possible with interferometry, a very long baseline interferometry, signals from 12 radio telescopes. One of them on board the Russian Spectre R satellite. Oh, Spectre. I remember. They used to talk about James Bond. I didn't think Spectre would pop up in here again. But this is really cool.
The resulting virtual telescope had a diameter of 193,000 kilometers.
It's huge.
That is so cool.
That's very huge. That concept of using long base interferometry and all these telescopes was, I thought, really fascinating. So, anyway, it goes on to talk more about the object, the galaxy OJ Simpson 287. OJ 287. very, very cool stuff. And because I happened to see this story, how when you're looking for something about telescopes, another one will pop up. The next one is the MWA. I shortened that because I didn't think I'd fit if I put the real name of it. I really didn't get to what the MWA was until way at the bottom, which is the Murchison Wide Array. It's another situation like, where we used to think of a telescope as something you put up to your eye, and, well, if you had a bigger telescope or a bigger mirror or a bigger, all that. And this is interesting for folks who are trying to keep track of all the amazing things we are coming up with in terms of regular optical and non-optical telescopes. The Murchison Wide Field Array says telescope in outback Western Australia, and they developed some new techniques. So what's cool is that I like this too because it reminds me a little bit, if anybody's had a chance to see the movie Don't Look Up, the thing is it started by a graduate student. It says this object was discovered by Curtin University honors student Tyrone O'Dougherty. Good old Tyrone O'Dougherty.
Good going, Tyrone.
Good on you, as we would say, Robert. That's what we always say up here in the when we're in the outback. That's the way we always say that. Anyway, but it's first of all, it's a really peculiar object, and it goes through the description of this whole kind of new class of thing. They're not even quite sure what to call it, but. Scrolling down, I think I remember it was like 400. It's relatively close. I want to say 4,000 light years, which is relatively close. Let me see where I can find that. But anyway, really, this is really cool stuff. They mentioned the square kilometer array. So
it said that this mysterious object was increasing, was bright and smaller than the sun,
right,
emitting highly polarized radio waves suggesting the object had an extremely strong magnetic field. Sounds like a neutron star.
Yep.
Right? Yep. Okay. It says it's a type of slowly spinning neutron star. Here we go. That has been predicted to exist theoretically, but nobody expected to directly detect one like this because we didn't expect them to be so bright. Well, it's bright because it's close. Right.
Well, that's one thing. And now they're probably taking that into consideration still, but, you know, as they there are a bunch of just interesting things about this, you know,
it says somehow it's converting magnetic energy to radio waves much more efficiently than anything we've seen before.
Yeah, that was probably the biggest.
That's nifty.
Yeah. And the other thing is that it switches on and off, and what they're basically calculating is that the next time it does, you know, it actually was coming on and going off in a little period of time, you know, which they see that in, say, things that are spinning and you know, the beam is crossing our field of vision kind of thing.
Right.
But so this is going to be kind of cool to watch because basically the gist of this story is that they're determining when and where, you know, when they'll be able to visualize it again and grab a lot more data.
Right.
So this is really cool. Neat stuff.
Very cool. Love it.
It's not like the old day. I mean, I remember when we were just getting all excited about telescopes having, you know, the fact that a telescope using shuffling all the pictures and picking the best, you could eliminate the fluctuations due to atmosphere and all that, and that was so cool. We're looking, especially all this long base interferometry and stuff for telescope fans like Robert and I are. That's exciting stuff.
Now, is really neat.
Meteorites.
Meteorites.
They're talking. I'm saying machine learning. To me, that's code word for let the robots find these things. But I'm saying. I don't know if I like that. They'd be looking for adamantium down here. No, it says that the machine learning points to prime places in Antarctica to find meteorites.
Okay.
And I'm looking at a bunch of guys down here. They're on a snowmobile. Looks like they found something, and they're going, hey, we found something. But the cool part of this story is really, first of all, you know, we think about how cool it is that because Antarctica is so unexplored and they have found some really amazing things, it's not necessarily the most likely spot, but if you scroll down just a little bit, you'll see a diagram, and they talk about how the creeping ice sheet, by studying all this kind of stuff, and that there are going to be, it's a little bit, first of all, I almost thought about it as like people that are panning for gold. You know, there are certain factors that will separate and concentrate things, you know, and sometimes it's water flow and it's gravity and it's all that kind of stuff. So it says combining a machine learning algorithm with data of the ice velocity and thickness, temperatures, so they're taking all the factors. It looks like that they're going to be what they call stranding zones, areas where things that have impinged upon the ice of the Antarctic continent are going to be more likely in certain spots. And if you know, we probably shouldn't give this away because everybody's going to run right down there. But there's another chart further down that is basically indicating where they feel the potential meteor-rich locations
will be. Wow, this is really neat.
It is cool, isn't it?
Uh-huh. What I find fascinating is it says to date about 45,000 meteorites have been plucked from the ice.
That's amazing.
But that's a fraction of the 300,000 bits of space rock estimated to lie somewhere on the continent's surface.
Amazing. So this probably could be a cable. This looks like it could be a new cable TV. You know, like the mystery
meteorites
of Oak
on ice.
Mystery of Oak Island or something here. Where,
oh God! No, please, no.
Not that. And if so, but but this is kind of cool because. By determining these particular regions, and as you look at it, they really do, you know, portend that this is where you would want to spend your time because the ice is basically moving them and piling them up against other land structures and things, as they say, stranding them in a zone. That's truly
great.
Cool.
That's really good stuff.
All right, I'm going to jump. Well, we're I did promise you a party, Robert. So here's the next. Good. The next one says party. And when I looked through this, I found this because some of these I wasn't. I you know, they sucked me in because they had a big picture of a slide rule right here at the first. People are going, what the heck is that? A slide rule? But for folks, you know, the way after we've all been so, you know, cooped up with COVID and all that, if things get a little bit, you know, more free and open, I'm saying, you know, the old, I know a lot of people had this philosophy and they've never lost it. Any reason for a party, right? That was kind of the way.
Absolutely.
But these are the top 10 science anniversaries that they say we should be thinking about in the year 2022. So we might scroll through a couple of these. Obviously, and I'm thinking Tom Siegfried, who put this together, he's got his calendar already marked. But man, when I look at this first picture at the top, this is one of the things that it talks about: priest and part-time mathematician. Now, see, he would have been better off to be a mathematician and part-time priest, is what I'm thinking.
But I agree. Yeah.
William Oughtred invented the slide rule, and here's a picture of, boy, this is the classic one. If you were attending college in the time before all everybody had calculators and things.
Yeah.
Everybody, especially the engineering students, would all have a slide rule, and you know, usually in a nice leather case. It was kind of like you clipped it on your belt because it was so important to have.
You sure did, because it was so cool to do.
Man. So anyway, so that's this is a list of 10 things. Now they start off with number 10. This is Al Naziri. This is the 1,110th anniversary of the death of this mathematician. And, you know, Al-Naziri is actually the name of a town. Naziri is a town. He said he died in 922 or thereabouts. And yeah. They say close enough. Now, see, hearing this from a math person is hard to believe. Close enough for top 10 purposes. He got himself a job in Baghdad with the caliph. And his job was to write treatises on math and weather, you know. Because back then, Baghdad was a center of science. There's no question about it.
Right.
Including many women scientists who were later to be minimized, I'm thinking. But it says one of his treatises for the caliph discussed how to determine the distance to upright objects. But it turns out he was a master of astronomy and geometry, and I thought this was really impressive. He said, among his surviving works is a translation and commentary on Euclid's Elements. He also attempted to prove of Euclid's famous postulate about parallel lines never meeting. So this guy is for those folks out here who follow closely all the math stuff, then invention of mathematical weather forecasting. Well, I don't know about that.
Is nine.
Yeah, nine.
Right.
I'm going to scroll through. Invention of the slide rule. The
400th anniversary. That is pretty cool.
That is big. Now, the only thing I'm going to say is I was pretty excited because I was not an engineering student, but I was like doing physics and biology, and I liked slide rules a lot. Instead of the goofy slide rule that these guys would have to, you know, like you would try to sit down in your car and you could injure yourself. I had one of the spiffy new circular slide rules.
I had one of those too. I loved that thing. Well,
and I thought to myself, what a great invention. This guy's going to make a fortune. And then in about 6 months, Hewlett Packard came out with their little neon display 8-digit, electronic calculator, which cost like about $400 or something.
And could add, subtract, multiply, divide, and do a square root.
That was about it. Now, the thing that I will say is my slide rule was particularly spiffy because the front part was a whole circular slide rule with, you know, slide rule with three different, you know, movable things. And on the back was the periodic table of the elements.
Ooh, is that cool? I didn't have that one.
Well, you had to pay more, Robert. It was cost 10 or 15 bucks or something. But it wasn't as expensive as the, you know, several hundred dollar Hewlett Packard. It's the kind of calculator that, you know, nowadays people give them away. Or it certainly was not a scientific calculator that could do much, as you said, beyond figure your grocery bill. Anyway, there's some more. I thought this one was really cool. Maria Gopert Meyer, who I had never heard of. And this is really instructive because it talks about the fact that she After earning her PhD, she married chemist Joseph Meyer and moved to the United States. Here, listen to this. She was allowed to teach classes where her husband was on the faculty. So first at Johns Hopkins, later at Columbia, and then Chicago. But she was never offered an actual job. She was just allowed to teach classes. Now, it turns out she was really important. It says her findings complemented similar work by Hans Jensen, with whom she later collaborated in writing a book on the nuclear shell model. And then Jensen and Gopert Meyer shared the 1963 Nobel Prize for Physics in that work. So, you know, we can't really give her a job, you know.
No.
So further down is Bohr, B-O-H-R. Of course, many people, you physics people know about Bohr. That guy, yeah. And, of course, for biology folks, we want to have a little bit of something. Gregor Mendel.
You know, this is 200th anniversary of his birth.
And they actually included Pioneer 10. This is interesting because I think that the launch of Pioneer 10, it's the 50th anniversary. This is really cool.
That is awesome.
Scrolling quickly down, certainly a really important one. The 100th anniversary of insulin being used to treat diabetes. And then, Science News has its 100th birthday. That's cool. And then I will have to say they even included a nice image of Louis Pasteur. And he was not, it says Robert, he was not a precocious youth.
He was not?
But later his attention shifted to chemistry. He became one of the greatest chemists of all times. And, of course, he invented canned food and all kinds of other amazing things. So anyway, make sure you get your calendar out before the end of the day, Robert, and fill it in with those.
I will. Thank you very much.
Order the diet root beer and cheese twists, and we'll be ready to roll. Okay, green hydrogen.
Already on.
We didn't quite get to this, and I will say again to folks who are listening that a lot of times we may go through these relatively quickly because, of course, Robert and I want to get as much science into the show as possible.
Absolutely.
But we do mention that, you know, sometimes it's important to go back and, you know, take what we talked about as your starting point and then read through more. But this is really, we actually did a little bit of talking, I think, a couple weeks ago about, I think it was blue ammonia and blue hydrogen. And they're giving all these different colors almost like they want you to know, you know, what is the better hydrogen. For example, green hydrogen, it would be something that's produced in a, you know, like as you would think, a green technique without creating other issues. Whereas blue might be, well, that's hydrogen that we're going to produce from a petroleum, and we're going to do this, and then we're going to try to sequester. But this particular story, even though it's kind of a weird little, they're talking about carbon-free green hydrogen, the idea that you're a process that doesn't produce a bunch of carbon that might, you know, then have hydrocarbons and carbon dioxide. This is a cool story for folks who've been deep into the weeds on this because it says they've developed a new water splitting. So we're talking about the catalytic splitting of water. The experiment that almost everybody may have seen or done is where you have, like, you know, a 12-volt battery and you have maybe carbon rods or electrode that you put into a solution that has ions in it, and you're going to get catalytically split oxygen from one and hydrogen from the other, and you can collect those, and it's a cool thing. But it hasn't been one of the most efficient ways just to, like, brutally do it that way. You know, they're talking about electrochemical water splitting. So the reason why this is cool, the folks at the Georgia Institute of Technology and Georgia Tech, is that this process is something that is so much more efficient. It makes it affordable and accessible for industrial partners. It says who want to convert to green hydrogen for renewable energy instead of conventional carbon-emitting hydrogen production from natural gas. I'm saying, yeah, very good. That's a very good thing. Scientists hope to replace natural gas and coal. Currently, you know, for electric production, if you have green hydrogen and you have, fuel cells, we're looking at a, you know, when you read through this article, it is a little depressing because it's talking about the fact that right now, only about 1% of the annual hydrogen production, they're talking about the year 2020, because it's just so expensive to do it. You know, you need a lot of electricity, and then you have to deal with the fact that most of the split, the techniques that use hydrocarbons mean you have to figure out what are you going to do with this, the leftover stuff, the carbons and the carbon, like monoxides. Right. And anyway, this is cool news. It's another one of the little pieces of, as they say, green energy, which many people are excited about. Some people think is, just a pie in the sky story, but every time something like this comes up. And the next right. one, the next story, Robert, Hot Times.
Very slick.
Click on that because I even saw this mention relative to this big snowstorm we're having. This is about the fact that we have, I think we may have touched on this last week as we were finishing up, the warmest records since record-keeping began. And we talked about this a little bit because basically the story is, the way I saw it on the Weather Channel was they were discussing how did the trend in the warming climate contribute to this storm that everybody it's going to be the bomb, that people are talking about.
Right.
The fact that the pressure is going to drop so quickly that it'll spin up. Well, the big thing is that it's being fed by that Gulf Stream right off the coast. And so when they're having this cyclone bomb emerging, the thing they point out, and I think you and I have talked about this so much, is that what feeds these storms and the storm production is like a huge contrast between a cold area and a warm area.
Right.
And so this story just kind of touches on that in the fact that they said over the Weather Channel was showing that over the past, it was more than 10 years, like maybe 15 years, we've had the 10 warmest years, and of course the last 8 years have been the warmest since we've started recording temperatures and things like that with the weather services that we've established. So later on today when folks in Boston are expecting to get 24 to 36 inches of snow, and the other thing that I think was astonishing was like hurricane force winds, if I heard correctly.
Yeah.
Wow.
What alarms me here is it says according to NASA's temperature record, Earth in 2021 was about 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 1.11 degrees Celsius, warmer than the late 19th century average, the start of the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, there's a clue.
Now, I keep hearing that we need to keep this temperature below 1.5 degrees.
Yeah, we're getting a little close, aren't we?
And they just said that it hit a record of 1.9. That seems to be over a tipping point that we're all concerned about.
Well, yeah, I remember Al Gore mentioning a tipping point not that long ago. Wow, yeah, I had not seen that. That's
that's a little concerning to me.
Getting close.
It's one thing if we're trying to keep it under 1.5 degrees and we're at 1.3, but we're at 1.9. That seems to be above 1.5, at least in all the math that
classes you took,
I've done. Yeah.
The margin of error decreases here.
Somebody needs to be making a big deal about that.
Well, I hope we will. And listen, to one of the things that even in the midst of all the political perturbations about the various things that President Biden has been rolling out, they're saying that, and I heard this even mentioned again, I think just last night, when they were talking about, climate change as an issue. Joe Manchin and Senator Sinema, they're basically all on board for the climate issue stuff. So, I'm going to say that's good news. I'm going to call that a slight silver lining. Quick look at E-Heat. I'm trying to remember why I put that one. Oh, this is, again, very... folks can read through this, but this is basically a really cool system for extracting heat from all sorts. If you read through this, you'll see that this is a cool. If you've looked into ways of generating electricity, one that you will have run across is the fact that you can take heat, thermoelectric.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you can convert, we know that you can take light and convert that in solar panels are cool, but this is the kind of thing that could be incorporated even, say, like on solar panels, but because any place where some of the light maybe just gets turned into heat and is then not converted to electricity could still be captured. But the big thing is there are so many places, they talk about hot water pipes, exhaust pipes on vehicles. There's so many places where if you could efficiently capture and convert that heat to electricity, it would be a big deal. And so this is a kind of cool thing from Penn State here, you know. And mostly it's that they've got the structure that basically will just fit around pipes and things like that. And it says, think about industrial power plants with pipes hundreds of feet long. If you can wrap these devices around an area, then you can generate kilowatts of energy from wasted heat, normally being just thrown away. Yeah, now the catfish.
What a great idea.
All these power plants oftentimes just dump it into like a river, and so you have a thermal pollution issue. So, anyway, very cool. Like this has a lot of detail about the gaps between the strips that provide the flexibility, and they're small and tight. And they're talking about a 72 thermocouple device that they exhibited reported the highest output of power. Of power and power density from a single thermoelectric generator. So that's a big step.
Yes, it is. That is really excellent. You know, I have long wondered that when you've got some really warm, hot place, and you're trying to figure out some way to throw away that heat. That, gee, wouldn't it be nice to be able to convert that into something good?
Yeah.
Even if to see that somebody's found that problem and looks like that they're coming up with good solutions.
Yeah, for the most part, they've just let it go. They just the thing that you often see, and I can say this in our neighborhood where there have been coal-fired power plants, even if they're relatively clean with scrubbers and all that, they typically create a big area where the heat makes a strange microclimate, and so people will be like, well, that's the best place to go fishing, right? You know, right down below the power plant, that kind of a thing. But it is definitely a waste. Okay, a quick look at the ECAT PV, because this was, I think if I got the right story, here it is. There was a statement in the Rossi blog about all his stuff where somebody asked him the question. Now, if for those who've been following like either Andre Rossi or the so-called brilliant light power, which started off as black light power, there are a lot of folks who've been doing things where they create a plasma and then they're trying to extract the energy. And Rossi, in this particular question, yours has come up, the guy said, first of all, is the SKLEP technology scalable in terms of output power? Because the first module that they're coming out with is analogous to, say, like smaller units that are like, AA batteries, and then you stack them up because they're scalable that way. So the person was asking the question, does it have to be a small thing like that? But the big question that was interesting in this thing was, it says, does the SKL electric production convert light energy into electrical energy?
Thanks. Right.
So down below, Rossi just says...
It says yes to number yes to number two.
So, and of course, in terms of like the production of the devices, they're basically saying that you could scale up the size of them. So instead of having to go through the intricacy of making a ton of little ones and then putting them together and wiring them up, you could just have bigger units. And I think that's what they're looking at here. The fact that he's implying that what they're actually doing is with his device and his process and his whole technology, that they're actually producing enormously bright plasma, and then they found a way to extract electricity from that maybe in something analogous to a photovoltaic thing, but. Not that we'll spend much time on this now, but it sparked a lot of conversation about there's like a whole range of other photovoltaic devices that people have been working on that are starting to show like 70% and 80% efficiency because they're like in close proximity to like a plasma, and also they're like a single frequency. You know, it's real complicated stuff. But I found that to be a fascinating question, especially as I said, I know that we talked about brilliant light power, which a lot of it got a lot of buzz on the stock market because they were doing this kind of thing. And they basically just said that's what they were doing. They were using a photovoltaic, you know, structure and then creating their plasma and then extracting the electricity. Now, they weren't getting the efficiencies that are being claimed here, but, you know.
Right.
Well, Robert, you know, we already, I know it's so sad that we've already talked about the cat brains.
Oh, no.
I don't think we need to go back and reiterate anything about that.
No.
But when I saw this story about the baboon spider, I don't know, I just had to click on it because I'm thinking to myself.
Baboon spider.
So I'm thinking, why in the world, could there be any good news or any reason to study the baboon spider? And Robert, there's actually good news in this story.
Says why king baboon spider venom is so painful.
This is,
you know, I've always wondered about that.
Well, this is, and again, this is, you know, the thing that's interesting is it almost in the first sentence it gives you the reason why you might not want to spend as much time in the outback of Australia in this place is because of this, the amazing creatures that, you know, Australia was just when, well, I guess Gondwanaland floated apart. Australia isolated a lot of interesting creatures, you know, and they evolved there. But this is a gorgeous spider, first of all.
Oh, yeah, gorgeous.
Just really gorgeous.
It says here that that they've uncovered the reason for the intense pain associated with king baboon spider venom. It says here the group describes a peptide in the venom involved in producing hyper excitability in nerve cells.
Oh, now there's something you don't want to really.
Ow!
There is a good,
like, hyper excitability.
There are a couple good news things in this. First of all, the bite of the king baboon spider, which, as it says, looks like a tarantula, lives. Oh, this one lives in Tanzania and Kenya. I know up above they were talking about Queensland, but okay, so. This particular species, it says, this is what's cool. It says it produces a lot of pain, but it's not lethal.
Whoa. You didn't read what is just before that says is not lethal.
That's what I said. It's not lethal.
Okay, good.
Isn't that amazing? You know, I used to watch those Tarzan movies where the guy wouldn't see the tarantula crawling up his thing till it got to his neck and he was done for. But
yeah, right.
So I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, this sounds, so far, this is it's a little bit of good news in that it's not lethal, but where is the good news in this story? But the thing that is so cool about this is in studying, it says they synthesized the peptide so they could do NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, to get the structure. And the cool thing that may come from this research is that they've gotten a real insight into the structure and the kind of channels and the things that cause pain, and they think that this the study suggests that a better understanding of how this particular spider venom produces this, you know, terrific pain in all these situations, it will lead to ways that we can again, without using like opioids and all kinds of really dangerous drugs, deal with people that have chronic pain or just, you know, pain in an injury situation and all that. It says it turns out that the little mouse, I feel badly for the little mouse, but
in the toe,
the top, I saw that was, I thought it was almost like, okay, so what's their point? They're saying, well, we're not going to hurt it much, we're just going to put the pain into its little toe. But they basically felt that what they were seeing in terms of as they put it, hyper excitability. It resembled the type of hyper excitability that they see in patients who experience a chronic pain. So this is, again, I like the idea when people actually, instead of spend all their time in a pharmaceutical laboratory trying to come up with the next successor to, say, OxyContin or something, that they look to nature for mechanisms that will provide some, you know, benefit. All right, a quick look at, I think this one on ice was just kind of a weird, fascinating thing. At first I thought it was going to be that whole thing about using ice to boil water. This is actually a cool story about heat transfer. And part of what this has to do with is, you know, the long story short is, in terms of like heat transfer and thermodynamics and how you may be able to do cool things in a big system. One of the things they talk about is that it says here when if you put ice on a hot surface,
mm-hmm.
So it says when it becomes a liquid, it talks about water can exist in three phases, of course, you know, blah, blah, blah. They're talking about the fact that the water, when a heat source is hot enough, like if it's really hot, according to Borrego, the research started with just looking at his theory about water droplets and the fact that, he would put a water droplet on a very hot surface. It says here, aluminum plate heated to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, 150 degrees Celsius, he says, or above, will no longer boil. Instead, the water vapor that forms becomes trapped beneath the droplet, creating a cushion that prevents the liquid from making direct contact. So then somebody thought, well, this is kind of cool, but what about if you put a chunk of ice on it, how will this all work out too? So they went through a whole system of researching this and got a few surprises, but another graduate student, Dan Cusumano, even when the aluminum was heated above 150, the ice did not levitate. So, you know, of course, this became his moment of curiosity and inquiry. What he found was that the threshold for levitation was dramatically higher, 550 degrees Celsius, rather than 100.
Okay.
And so the question was going on, and this is really fascinating to me. Again, here's the graduate students doing all the work. Basically, what they came to find was that by, you know, including this concept of having ice and the water, that they were developing a very novel method of heat transfer. So I was looking for the temperature difference of the ice is uniquely creating across the water has changed what happens to the water itself, because now most of the heat from the hot plate has to go across the water to maintain the extreme differential. Right. So there's not enough of it left there to actually boil, and you don't have the floating on the vapor. So it's kind of like essentially you've eliminated the one phase because it can never emerge, because in order for the difference, you know, the big differential across that area, all the heat has to be, it's moving, it's being transferred. I think part of what they're looking for this is that it transfers faster. And they're talking about the idea that, you know, again, you get to where they have systems that will rapidly cool nuclear power plants, for especially an emergency situation. You know, just break out some ice cubes and throw it on.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, and then they were talking about having a jet that actually sprays ice chips instead of water. And I mean, part of it just sounds like, well, sure, that makes sense because there are more phases that you have to go across.
Right, exactly.
But they're looking at it as a system that, in a very large measure, increases the ability to transfer heat away from something hot, and in the case of, say, a nuclear power plant, something dangerous, too. So that's very fascinating. All right, so we might make it through these, Robert. I don't know.
We actually might.
I'm jumping to iron.
Okay.
And so this goes to one of the fascinating things we've always talked about. When people think that the primitive people just about, you know, they were just so primitive, they just couldn't do much. Well, they're now finding Arctic hunter-gatherers were actually doing advanced iron work more than 2,000 years ago.
You're kidding.
And they were looking at these northeastern Sweden molded bronze buckle. Front and back have uncovered advanced iron production and metalworking among hunter-gatherers who lived more than 2,000 years ago. This is a cool story.
So this is way before what we call the Iron Age.
Well, it looks like because they're talking about the fact that these folks were barely hunter-gatherers, but they were still. Study is particularly insightful because the metal is iron, typically considered a more challenging metallurgy than people that were just working copper or gold. And the makers are hunter-gatherers, historically assumed to have only basic technologies. All right, so this is a cool story. I'm going to tell folks to read through this because I see we have barely a minute left. I should have started the music.
Looks like about time to start the music. This is fascinating.
Now, the only thing I'm going to do is I'm going to click on the Neanderthal story, and I'm going to ask people to read this as I start up the music. Or, you know, get to this later and enjoy it. Because the gist of this, you know, you and I are always pumping up the Neanderthals, Robert. They're like, I think they're doing stuff more important. What this story talks about is the fact that there's a whole bit of great detective work among archaeologists here. But they're talking about the fact that they believe that Neanderthals were starting to turn forest into grassland, in other words, the beginning of agriculture and stuff, or the, you know, herding of animals, etc., 125,000 years ago. So when you when you read through this, you'll be fascinated, as I was, I'm sure. I'm getting ready to shut off the